This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Well, Steve, I think we can retire now.
Let's do it. I'm ready. Let's go.
We've managed to piss off every dumb religious person on YouTube, and they've spent the entire week talking about. Monday was with Brett Keene. We had the thing that happened with Brett Keene, and he's got 6 videos since Monday out about you and me. Funny enough, he put the picture of me on a video that he says questions for Kyle from Non Sequitur and Ben from the Drunken Peasants. And he didn't even ask me any questions.
Yeah, I watched that particular video. I actually watched that video. I was still waiting for a question. Not one question ever was forthcoming. So what was the point of the video? He basically was just chastising. If I'm mentally retarded, you should have pity on me. That's what his argument was.
But he's not. I'm not even going into it, but he's not. Then last night we had G-Man and Mr. Intelligent Design, which, you know, somebody put this on the on our comments on the video. They said, I often wondered who was worse or something like that, G-Man or Mr. ID. And last night I answered the question for them. And I got to tell you, like, I really like Edgar. Like, he's wrong in everything that he says, but he's very lovable. He's like a guy you can't help but love. So, I mean, that was good at least. And then G-Man spent all day long talking about you and I, and I think we can retire now. Happy. We've done our yeah. jobs.
But it's funny because he made a video with you, about you, I guess, or to you, which had nothing to do with you. And then he's right. going over to my channel and he's leaving comments on one of my videos threatening to TOS, yeah. false flag, and shut me down. And then a few minutes later go on air and say, I'm just, you know, a Christian. I forgive these guys and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, people don't realize, but now that Brett Keene is beyond duplicitous. He is pretty much the most vile human being I've ever ran across on the internet. Nothing he says is ever true at all. I don't think he's ever uttered any kind of thing that was ever correct. But yeah, he's just a vile person. And yet he's literally threatening to shut down my channel. I mean, if he's that triggered, then
you know what
he has before. He tried before back in the day. Not my channel.
Brett left that comment on your channel so that nobody would give him hell if he left it on ours. You know, he just wanted to make sure that you read it and didn't want to hear anybody else's, you know, that was associated with the video say anything. He's just duplicitous. But let me, that's enough about them. I was just checking right before the show started tonight, and we are about 203 people away from 20,000. So I have made a prediction. I told me and Steve talked about this for it's about 6 months now, Steve, where I said, right, We wanted to hit 20K before Christmas. So it looks like we're on track to do that. It looks like we are on track to do that. So please, if you aren't subscribed, please, please do that and click the, I've got to get better at this because we're the, I think one of the only channels that don't ever say when we, you know, when we start our show, like and subscribe and hit the bell.
Notification. Yeah, we put the end card. But here's the thing. I've been telling people this, that share button below is tracked. And so when you hit that share, which is next to the like and dislike button, that gets tracked. And the more people that share that, the more it becomes trending and the more the algorithm picks it up, the more people, it gets recommended to. So if you have 1,000 people watching, even if, you know, 10%, even if there's 100 people hit that share, that's a huge number that the algorithm would pick up. So, you know, we do appreciate that. If you just hit share it to anywhere, you know, it doesn't matter. That link will be tracked.
Yep. And we appreciate it, guys. Thank you for all of your support as always. We really do appreciate it. Okay. So let's introduce, Andrew. Well, one second, Andrew, I forgot that after tonight's show, we are going to have another show following this one at 10 o'clock. The Mind of God will be back here, and he's going to be debating biblical prophecy. The other gentleman, I haven't actually know what I'm supposed to call him yet, so I'm not going to say what the email says yet, so I don't want to dox him, but he will be taking on somebody that thinks that biblical prophecy is not in any way, shape, or form relevant, or none of it came true. So that'll be immediately following this at 10 o'clock. Okay, so tonight we have Andrew Jasko. I'm saying that right? It's Jasko?
You got it.
Okay, perfect. Just to tell you a little bit about him, he was a Pentecostal minister. He was preparing to become a missionary to India. He studied the Bible at the Evangelical Christian Wheaton College and obtained his Master of Divinity from Princeton Seminary. And now he is studying to, you said a doctorate in psychology, right?
Yep, I'm a clinical psychologist in training. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. So, Andrew Jasko, thank you for coming on and joining us.
It's great to be here.
And we're going to be covering quite a few different topics tonight. We're going to try to fit them all in. And if we don't, you'll just have to come back. And I think we're going to start out with the life after dogma part and then move into maybe some psychedelics and sexuality towards the end. But we'll be covering the topics tonight. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about you and how you came into Life After Dogma.
Absolutely. So I have a blog called lifeafterdogma.org, and I have hundreds of pages of articles focused on exposing the psychological abuse of religion. And I believe that religion tends to traumatize people and to create psychological dysfunction on a massive, massive scale. And it's religion constitutes one of the most psychologically abusive systems of oppression of all times. And it's time for us to wake up and take inventory of the damage that's being done, not just intellectually and scientifically, but the human suffering that's being caused by people who are trapped in these systems of fear and oppression. So that's my work, is to expose that damage through creative writing and speaking. And my background, I grew up in the Assemblies of God, Pentecostal Charismatic Christianity. My father is a minister of a large church in New Jersey, and I was born into that church and given a prophecy before I was born that I would help lead the people of the world back to God. And so I always grew up wanting to be a missionary, wanting to bring about the second coming of Christ as kind of like this Jason Bourne figure of Christianity. That was my prophetic mantle. And so I took Christianity very, very seriously for my whole life. I went to church 3 or 4 times a week, did the youth group, the whole Christian thing. I've been a part of many, many Christian groups and cults. And I studied at Wheaton College in Bible and theology, spent some time as a Pentecostal minister. And during that time, I went with a missionary organization to India to be an undercover missionary to participate in what's known as relational evangelism, which is trying to win people over through friendship and convert Hindus and Muslims to Jesus. So I decided that my vocation was to be a lifelong missionary to India, because it was a really strategic thing to do, as the Bible teaches that through world evangelism, every tribe, tongue, and nation should be reached with the gospel, every distinct ethno-linguistic tribal people group. And when that happens, Jesus is going to come back. So my career goal was the second coming of Christ. That's what I was going for.
And, so they didn't do too well with the prophecy, with you being the one to lead everybody back to Christ, did they? Because here you are trying to push them away from it.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe in a roundabout way.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was it that made you, you said, you know, you were doing the, you were a minister of a Pentecostal church for a little bit. What was it that finally kind of woke you up or started creating doubt towards your faith?
So I had a rude awakening during my time at Princeton Theological Seminary. I went to Princeton Seminary because I considered myself a student of the Bible. I wanted to know what the Bible said, not what any particular teacher or denomination said. So I went there to learn the Greek and Hebrew languages and the historical context of the Bible. And it wasn't really the intellectual issues that got me questioning my religion. And I think this is the case for a lot of people who leave religion. You know, most of us aren't in religion because it makes sense intellectually, because it's a good logical proof or system. We're in it because of what it does for us. It gives us a sense of identity, community, belonging, and tries to meet some logical needs at least. So I struggled with anxiety, just tremendous anxiety for most of my life. And I was really, really miserable. I went through periods of depression and intense, obsessive cycles, just being caught in my mind. I mean, I would pray the sinner's prayer sometimes thousands of times a day, because we were taught this doctrine of eternal insecurity, which is one of the psychological means of control that happens in religion is that you're never really sure of your salvation. There's always the threat of hell hanging in the background, even for the most faithful. So I was just so anxious. And I said to myself one day, I'm just going to do whatever it takes to get free of fear. I just can't live like this anymore. So I prioritized mental health in my life just because I needed to function. And when I made that commitment to my mental health, to getting better, to seeking counseling, and I had done this for years. I'd also seen Christian therapists that never really worked for me either. I tried the system to its max, and it didn't work for me. And I think that's the case for most people who leave religion. Most people who leave are the ones who are really sincere and who are really committed to integrity. And they leave because of their devotion, not in spite of it. So that was definitely the case for me. And as I was unpacking this thing and prioritizing my own welfare, I began to see the psychological toxicity of the Bible. And I saw that these oppressive doctrines were throughout the entire Bible. And I tried to attribute it to my particular background or my experience. And I tried out more liberal forms of Christianity. I was a Presbyterian minister for a couple months too after I graduated seminary, but I just couldn't get around the Bible. I saw these abuses were the fault of the Bible and of faithful interpretation to the Bible. I think abuse happens mostly because people get the Bible right, not because they're bad at interpreting it. So I began to see all these toxic psychological doctrines that were resulting in low self-esteem, perfectionism, sexual dysfunction. My sexuality was a huge part of it. I hated my sexuality. I viewed it as a curse from God, because if you believe that sex is only good within marriage, that means if you're not married, for all intents and purposes, sexuality is evil. It's bad. It's dangerous. It has the potential to, my penis had the potential to throw me into hell, literally, in that system. I mean, that's scary. That's so disastrous. That's incredibly abusive and oppressive. I mean, where sexuality is repressed and shamed at the level of fantasy, of desire and thought, just having a thought. Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 says, if you lust after a woman in your heart, you've committed adultery. It's better for you to cut off a part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. So in one verse, Jesus, the historical Jesus, by the way, he says he associates sexual fantasy with burning in hell, with the worst torture imaginable, and with castration, cutting it off. And kids grow up hearing this message, you know, as they're going through puberty, and associating sexual fantasy with hellfire torture. That is a severe form of sexual psychological abuse. I can hardly think of a more severe form than that. So, and teach, that's just one example of some of the traumatic doctrines that I experienced. So, but I tried hard to make this thing work for me because it was my whole life and my whole identity, my career, everything. My religion was everything. So, you know, to give that up is a really, really serious thing. And not to mention just how scary it is to question your faith when you have a fear of something like hell and when you know you could lose your whole community. I mean, it's a really tough thing for anyone who goes through it. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think a good message that somebody can take from that is, everybody just free your penis. Free your penis.
People don't want me to free my penis, believe me.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Like, just where it's at, yeah.
So there wasn't like one, or do you remember the day or the time or around the time that you just decided that there was nothing to the Bible and that you had to break away from it? Like, was there one like clear moment, or, you know, somebody said something or you read something that you can go back to sort of start at that point?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple key breakthrough moments that I remember, but now that I'm out of it and I look back, I can see chinks in the armor, holes and cracks in the system throughout my whole life that I couldn't see and I wasn't aware of. And I think this is the case for many Christians. Where we have to be religious, you have to live with a ton of cognitive dissonance, and you have to compartmentalize and separate your areas of your life from other areas. Because, like, you have family members often who aren't religious and you know they're going to hell, but you still have to treat them with family. So there's all this separation and dissonance. I always struggled with some of the perfectionism of the law, got the message of indoctrination, which says that you're not good enough, your best isn't enough, and that you have to be perfect. It takes morality to an absurd degree and is a very torturous system. But so things like this, the way the church treated homosexuals, it never fully sat right with me. I had to come up with these excuses and say, well, it's part of the fallen world and you have to rely on God's grace if you're gay. But things like that never really worked for me. But when I was a Christian, I wasn't able to see that they weren't working. I had to find ways of reinterpreting them to make them less atrocious within my worldview. Because I had to preserve the system at all costs, because that meant preserving my own sense of safety. So that's why people are inspired to do all kinds of crazy philosophical, apologetic, nonsensical arguments, you know, not so much because it makes sense, but because it has to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, I'm in danger of the fires of hell or God's judgment or other things. So we're driven by these survival instincts and these impulses that I think are usually more powerful than just this raw intellect that usually serves our lower drives. So to answer your question, one of those was my second year of seminary, just when I had that epiphany and I said, I'm done with this fear. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get it out of my life, and I'm going to trust that God will keep me, which didn't end up working out the way I thought. But so that was one moment for me. And then after I graduated seminary, I ended up going to Burning Man, which was also interesting.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's this giant festival in the desert in Nevada, where people do drugs sex, rock and roll. I mean, that's a stereotype, but it's very much about self-actualization, about going for your dreams, honing into your intuition, and not giving into any kind of a dogmatic system that or ideology that's in place, whether that's in government or religion or anything else. And so that was a formative experience for me. After I graduated seminary, I realized that I couldn't be a missionary to India anymore. I was going to be a missionary to India to train Hindus and Muslims to start churches to bring about the second coming of Jesus Christ. So that was just a crushing experience, giving up that dream. And while I was in New York City, I was partying with my burner friends and then ministering. So I would have all this body paint on me and just come home from a night of partying, 2 hours later, put on my suit and go preach. And it was just this torturous experience. Yeah, I was just in the middle of these two worlds. And eventually I just quit my job. I couldn't handle it anymore. And one day I woke up and I realized I'm no longer a Christian and I'm not afraid. It just kind of happened to me. And I knew that I was on my way out, but it was a slow process of denial, of trying harder, because the system teaches you that there can't be something wrong with the system. If it's not working, it's not because the Bible's at fault. It's because you're at fault. You're not trying hard enough. You don't have enough faith. You're not a good enough Christian. Or you're experiencing the dark night of the soul, which is this psychological mechanism that's absurd. It says, if you're not experiencing God's presence for a while, it's because you're a super Christian and God's testing you by withdrawing his presence. So stuff like this that should normally cause people to question is reinterpreted to serve the system, is reinterpreted as proof for why the system's true. So there are all kinds of reasons that people try to stay in, but eventually I had this awakening and I left the religion and I was totally crushed. I mean, my whole identity, my life was thrown into chaos. I isolated from my family, my community of thousands of people, Bible professors, missionaries, all of that. It was a very, very challenging transition. And I ended up packing my bags and moving to California on a whim and finding my healing here through a lot of different things. I mean, through psychedelics, through meditation, through psychology, through really psychotherapy was the biggest thing. And now I'm blogging and calling out these abuses and trying to raise awareness about these issues.
So I want to go back just briefly for a second to the, when you said that, number one, I think it's awesome that your deconversion story starts at Burning Man. I think that's fantastic. But the
well,
point
it doesn't
where
start
you said
there.
That
it was a catalyst. It was just a part. I was already, it would have happened without that. But yeah, it was helpful.
Yeah. How is it, what's the mindset that you're in when, like you said, you're going out partying, you've got the body paint on, and then 2 hours later, you're changing into a suit. And, you know, supposedly, I guess, and this is just me guessing, but you're standing in front of the you know, on the pulpit on Sunday, telling people how they, you know, they should go out and live pious lives. What's the mindset there? How are you feeling, you know, in terms of having to do that? That seems like that would be difficult to kind of to bear with after a while.
It was torture. It was driving me crazy. And I mean, at that point I was preaching messages that more or less aligned with what I believed, which is hard to do with the Bible, but I managed to do it. And I mean, I was partying because I wanted to have fun. I wanted to enjoy my life. All the stuff that I wasn't allowed to do when I was a kid growing up, because I was part of this thing called the youth group, which is an indoctrination camp for kids who want to have sex. Basically, it's to keep kids from having sex and to keep them from not being Christians. And it's a very isolating experience to be told you can't do these natural things like have fun because it doesn't serve the kingdom of God, or just be a part of your peer group and your community. So it was just normal, fun, healthy expression. But I could not handle that dissonance. You're right. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. It was torture. So I ended up just quitting pretty soon after that. which I kind of regret retrospectively because of the financial fallout. And there, a group exists, by the way, it's called the Clergy Project. I joined this group. It completely changed my life. It's for closeted ministers and clergy. And by the way, if you're a clergy questioning your faith or a Bible professor or a missionary, there's a group called the Clergy Project. Check it out. It's for people who are questioning or have left their faith and providing resources to help you transition your career so you can feed your family and feed your kids and start a new life. And so you don't have to keep preaching what you don't believe. And there are many, many people who are trapped in their ministry jobs because they don't know what else to do.
I think that's very good that you put that out there. I'll put the link in the description for on that as well. I want to jump now into like what religion, when you say religious trauma and the, you know, the psychological abuse, I want to kind of dive into what you see in that, because I know from my own experience, religion almost, and I can't believe that I'm about to say this, it's like a wake up call every time I say this, but As a gay man, I was almost married to a woman. I mean, I came this close to getting married to someone that I really didn't. I mean, I loved her in a sense, but not in the, like, you know, I want to spend the rest of my life sense with you. And I was willing to do that because I thought it was the right thing to do. You know, that if I just showed that I'm serious, those other kind of urges would just eventually go away. And so, I mean, it was this close. Happy. That would have changed my entire life. I mean, can you imagine me with kids, Steve?
Yeah, actually I can. I'm just wondering if she's single now, you know, hook a brother up. And by the way, I kind of want to add this while I can, before we go too far, you know, you had talked about the abstinence thing. Do you know who Joshua Harris is?
Yeah.
Joshua Harris was a pastor of the Covenant Life Church. Yeah. I kissed
I
dating
his book,
goodbye,
I
right?
Kissed dating goodbye. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you know he recently came out and said that was the worst mistake he ever made, and he's now denouncing it and asking for it to go out of print?
I wonder if he's questioning his religion. I always wonder about people who come out and say things like this. But yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
He's still a Christian. Yeah.
Okay.
At the moment, he's still Christian, but he has realized the damage it's done, and he's actually mortified listening to some of the horror stories of people that have read his book and took his what he now calls bad advice. So...
And you mentioned being gay. This is one of the huge issues, and it's just one issue. There are so many other issues. 700,000 Americans have undergone conversion therapy. 700,000. 77,000 more will go through it before they're 18. This is according to a study at the Williams Institute. I have to find the link. And many of those will be done by licensed professional counselors. And being gay was illegal in the United States until recently because of religious legislation. So, I mean, this stuff is, I mean, that's so traumatizing. Have what?
How many of those conversion therapies have ever worked? Because the reason I left the Mormon Church was partly because of that reason. Actually, it was one of the big reasons because they had actually funded something called the Evergreen Project, which was reparative and conversion therapy, which I thought was completely scientifically bullshit. And then they were trying to prevent gay marriage in California back in 2008 with Prop 8. So my investigation is that conversion theory has never worked in any way, shape, or form. And by the way, I'm not gay, but you know, it just bothered the shit out of me at the time that they were promoting this.
It doesn't work. It almost never works. And I mean, it's atrocious that people are still calling homosexuality a sin. It's not a sin. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It should be celebrated. But people believe this doctrine because of the Bible. The Bible says that homosexuality is detestable, that it's disgusting, that gay people should be killed. I mean, these verses are in the scripture. I mean, these attitudes are ancient Iron Age ideologies that people believed thousands of years ago. And people who believe the Bible have to find clever ways of reinterpreting or dealing with some very apparent literal words just because they're in these ancient textbooks. But that message has traumatized a huge group of people. And how about women? Women are the biblical view of women is property of men. Throughout the entire Bible, their property. In the Ten Commandments, it says, that you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his ox or his slave or his property or anything else that belongs to him. So a woman is a property item like a slave or a house. It belongs to a man. Why are these documents in the highest courts of our land, these patriarchal documents? I mean, God has a penis. God is a man in Jesus. God is the embodiment and deification of patriarchy. In the biblical text, women are commanded to, they attain salvation through childbirth. They're to be silent in the churches. There's so much shaming of women, and so many people leave religion because they're women, or because they're gay, because of the way that they're born, which is beautiful and a part of nature.
I often say that the best thing that anybody can do is, or the quickest way to become an atheist is to read the Bible, because Steve and I talk a lot all the time. And one of the interesting things is, if you're religious and you're going to church every Sunday, Wednesday night, you're very involved within the church community. You're sheltered almost, and you're kind of in a bubble, because Steve and I, there's examples of this all the time. Steve has one where he talked, even a couple, it was very recently, where you talk about Jephtha, the military general who sacrificed his daughter. We don't hear these stories when we, when growing up in the church. You don't hear this about the slavery or, you know, the really horrible things. And it's interesting when you get out to sort of look, and then you get all of these other stories. Because actually, one of the things that kicked off my doubt was, I was watching an Aaron Ra video, and he was talking to somebody on the Atheist Experience and telling them about slavery in the Bible. And I remember very vividly going, slavery's not in the Bible. There's nothing to do with about slavery in the Bible. And you go and you look, and it is there. It's there. And so I'm instantly like, why have I not ever heard about any of this before? And it's amazing how they're able to kind of keep that hidden.
So I want to pick this up. And there's a perception that the New Testament God is nicer than the Old Testament God, or that Christianity's gotten better and it's gotten more loving. It's not better. It's worse. It's just more pernicious, and it's more subtle. What happened is very literal oppressive doctrines are turned into metaphorical, spiritual, internalized oppression. So let me give you an example. Last night, or a night ago, I just wrote an article. It's called, Was the Bible Inspired by Dark Spiritual Forces? Why does God demand human sacrifice and spirit possessions of his followers? Is God the devil? All right. So I went through the entire Bible. The sensual right of Christianity is human sacrifice throughout the entire Bible. And this is the history of it. So the Bible commands the sacrifice of animals. And that was the center of the Old Testament temple cult, was that animal sacrifice appeases a wrathful deity. And that was what the priest did, is they oversaw these animal sacrifices. And this culminates in the sacrifice of Jesus. And God makes a relational agreement with his people through blood pacts or covenants. That's how the seal of the relationship is, through the shedding of blood and blood sacrifice. And so Jesus is slaughtered. God accepts that human sacrifice. And now what happens in the New Testament is this is turned into an ideological sacrifice. Christians are commanded to give up their agency, to surrender their critical thinking, the willpower, and to ask for spirit possession of a foreign entity named the Holy Spirit, or Jesus. Come into my heart. I'm a sinner. Take over my life. I'm not my own. And it says in the Bible, you're to be a living sacrifice. You were bought with a price. Your bodies are not your own. You're a temple of the Holy Spirit. So what happens is every thought and action of the Christian is a human sacrifice. No longer is this a literal thing. It's total enslavement. And not only that, but you're possessed by a foreign spirit who polices your thoughts like a Google search engine. God says that he searches the heart and examines the mind to pay back everyone according to what they're done in the book of Jeremiah, and we're to take captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. So we have here thought crimes, crimes of emotion, where it's not just your actions, but you have to be obedient to this foreign deity who possesses your soul and your body, and you have to sacrifice yourself and your life, if need be, in martyrdom, and give up all your possessions if he calls you to, and all your relationships. It's a total surrender, slave master, obedience, relationship. Human sacrifice is the central right, and it's the ideology here. And spirit possession. You want to call the devil demonic? You want to call demon? I don't know who's more demonic than this Holy Spirit or this Jesus character and this Yahweh.
That is so true. When you lay it out, it's truly creepy.
Yeah. So if you want to believe in evil spirits, then, I mean, look, read the Bible. You know, I mean, maybe I shouldn't be an atheist. I'm starting to consider the existence of a devil and this deity in the Bible really makes me question my atheism.
It is true, though. Yep. I mean, when you think about like who set up the entire, game of life. When you talk about God, who put Adam and Eve, let's say we go with the story, he put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden on the planet, which is a big planet, right? And he decided to plant the one tree that would cause all of this sin and destruction and ultimately killing his son. He puts that tree in that garden where they are. Out of this entire planet, he could have put it anywhere, but he put it in that garden specifically, obviously knowing what would happen. And the one person that decided to give him
a tree.
Yeah, exactly. Or he could have been like, oh, you ate of that tree? And that was a shitty thing to do. I'm going to forgive you, though, because I'm God and I don't want to see any of this other shit happen. But he didn't do any of that. He did not do any of that. He instead said, well, shit's on now. And from that period on, it's just, I mean, all sort of shit. So, I mean, that to me, like, blows it out the water. The one good guy in the story was was what they call the serpent saying, hey, God's keeping something from you. You should check that tree out over there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the kingdom of God is a totalitarian, authoritarian regime of a warmongering fascist whose name was Yahweh. And I mean, you can see Christianity in terms of holy war. The Great Commission is an ideological jihad. Holy war or jihad runs throughout the entire Bible. So God is this king, and he's modeled after an authoritarian ancient Near Eastern king. This guy Yahweh was a Canaanite deity in the Canaanite pantheon. Israel used to be a tribal people, and they were polytheistic. And when they became monotheistic, they adopted Yahweh as the one true king to rule them all. And during this time, they were brutally oppressed by foreign nations, many foreign nations, and they literally saw their infants dashed to pieces before their eyes. You see this written about in the Bible. And so they were severely traumatized and suffering, and they cried out for revenge, for vengeance, and they elected a brutal king to do the trick, a strong man named Yahweh. And he set up his authoritarian regime. He made them his chosen people, his special people. He commanded them to genocide. The book of Joshua is religious ethnic cleansing propaganda. That's the genre the book is written in. And and so in the New Testament now, this kingdom is advanced through the Great Commission, which is an ideological holy war, where God recruits Christian soldiers to spread the gospel message and to conquer every tribe, tongue, and people with this kingdom through conversion. And people are made subjects to this kingdom and servants through surrender of their souls and their agency and their spirit and their volition and everything. And in the end, in the book of Revelation, Jesus comes back with weapons of mass destruction, destroys most of planet Earth through the plagues of Revelation, kills most of humanity, violently sets up his regime, internal concentration camp of hell, and I mean, the other concentration camp is heaven. Heaven isn't much better than hell, by the way. It's just control and domination through pleasure instead of pain. Either way, it's about the worship of an authoritarian narcissist who's an egotist. I mean, why are we worshiping? Why do we even worship I mean, it's all about his ego. How does this benefit anyone but him? So really, but this all makes sense if we see it in terms of the idea of a king. When people look to their idea of God, in ancient times, the person who gave justice was the king, right? That was the way, the dominant way of rule. And usually kings were not good people. Usually they were in their place through violence and through fear. And usually they were the biggest criminal in the land, and they were afraid because someone might kill them to take their place. That's why people bow when they see the king, so they can't conceal a weapon, so they can't threaten him. And they ruled through fear. So that's why the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom in the Bible. It's not love, it's fear, because fear was the basis of authoritarian kings. And I mean, so it's reflected, and it's throughout the whole Bible. You know, obedience is more primary than love. It's unconditional love is a joke, because it's love with strings attached. You're only love if you believe correctly and if you behave correctly. Otherwise, you're damned and condemned. There is love, and there are good and beautiful things in religion. And I know that most people who are religious are really sincere, you know, great people. I love religious people. I don't want to tear them down. I don't want to tear down the great things that they're doing in the world. But I think there's a better way to accomplish love, raising awareness, going about healing, tolerance, learning, openness to other forms of ways of living and ideology. There's a better way to do all these great things without all the abuse and trauma.
There, when you say it like that, it everything you said was so true, but it puts, I think, how anybody could want to actively pursue that or support that. I just don't understand that. You know, because you laid it out perfectly. You took all the filler off of it and just laid out what the timeline was, and how you can hear that and say, yeah, I want to, you know, spend my life going against natural, urges that I have, or whatever the case may be. And the best example that I think you laid out there is that heaven is not any better than hell when you ultimately think about it, because it is about his ego. You are to worship him and praise him. And I asked, there's a friend of ours named Paul Agia. He was having a conversation with an apologist named SJ, and he asked her a question I had never heard before, and it just like hit me like a ton of bricks, because I think it's such a powerful question, and how an apologist can answer this, I have no idea. But he said, me and my mother are very close. I love my mother, and she's extremely religious. She's in church every Sunday. And when she dies and I die and she's in heaven, she's going to know that I'm in hell. So is God going to wipe that memory from her because there's no sorrow in heaven and she won't remember she had a son, so it won't really be my mother? Or will she have to spend eternity knowing that her son is being punished in hell? And so I think that's a very telling question, because if God does wipe that away and makes her forget, you know, that she had a son who might be, you know, burning in hell, then it's not really his mother. And then you're just your brain's been wiped clean, and you have no, memories of your former self. Are you really you then in heaven?
It's a form of slavery and manipulation, and it really doesn't make sense. And people, I mean, the whole school of apologetics, I see it as an attempt to try to rationalize absurdities. You know, to try to put people's consciences to rest. That's why it really exists, because religious people actually know better. Like, they really do know on some level that what they believe is not scientific, that a lot of it's immoral, that a lot of it's unhealthy, but they need to find ways to make it work, because it's not about whether it makes sense. It's about what it does for us. So, I mean, that makes sense of a lot of it to me. But yeah, I want to get into a little bit about the psychological damage and trauma, and then how to heal that too. There are for people who are in religion and who have left it and who are reeling from the benefits. One of the the most damaging doctrines of all of Christianity is the idea of sin, which is completely invalid according to almost any psychology out there. It doesn't explain human nature at all, like why we do bad things, because we're sinful. But the teaching is that you're born evil, that you are deserving of wrath just because you exist, that you're bad, you're not good enough, you're wicked, you can't trust your heart and your intuition, you're bad. And it's systematic shaming, it's soul trauma, it's a very deep wounding, the idea of sin. And this message is really a very simple message. It's essentially that you're bad, just like sexual repression. The message that people take away is that sex is bad. You know, that it's very simple. These heart level one or two sentences are things that we actually end up taking away. So, I mean, and what mother says to her newborn baby, look at this wicked, evil thing. You know, it's completely counter to nature and instincts, this message that we have. So what it does is it breaks down self-confidence and our relationship to ourself. It's identity trauma. And I think that religion tends to traumatize our identity, and so that we give up our identity and trade it in for an identity that's the system. We need to be saved from ourselves, and we can't trust ourselves. And suffering is a result, is our fault. So it's trying to make sense of the issue of suffering, the problem of suffering, and to provide a solution. The problem is the way it goes about that is it ends up disrupting the self-relationship, the way I relate to myself, and I'm viewing myself as bad and untrustworthy. So I develop like a drug kind of relationship to the religious system, and just in order to feel good about myself, when I'm told that I'm bad, that I need saving, I go to the system through prayer and confession. So the notion of confession creates obsessive compulsive thinking and behavior. You do it in person, but it's primarily an idea that takes place in your own mind. You're taught that the deity lives inside your brain, like a surveillance chip or like a psychological construct. A judge is internalized who's policing your thoughts, and your thoughts can throw you into hell because you have thought crimes and crimes of emotions. Anything that you think can be used against you in the system. So what happens is your mind becomes an unsafe place. And this fundamentalist system thrives by creating unsafety. And religious devotion is driven by anxiety, by creating anxiety. So this fear of hell looms in the background, and it drives devotion. And this fear of offending the deity in your own mind, and because of that, it keeps you stuck in your head, always trying to police your thoughts, always trying to find relief whenever you have a bad thought. I've got to read my Bible to make that feeling or thought go away. I've got to confess. I've got to go to church. I've got to try harder. And it's this vicious cycle of anxiety, and it creates these compulsive rituals of spiritual disciplines that drive you to the system to find relief. But the behavior of confession or Bible reading or good works reinforces the judgment that you're trying to hide from, that you're trying to get away from, because it reinforces the message that you're a sinner needing grace. So it's this cycle that keeps on going. It's like an addiction. It cultivates an addictive quality to it, and it creates obsessive compulsive thoughts. It creates anxiety, tremendous anxiety. It exaggerates threats. So like, for instance, demon possession is a threat that's given, or preachers will often say, you could die at any moment. You know, if you don't give your life up to Jesus, you don't know what's going to happen to you. So people are threatened with death and destruction, or God could judge me, or just by virtue of living in a country with people who aren't Christians, they could bring about national judgment and God's wrath. So a sense of paranoia is created because I could be unsafe because of my neighbors who aren't religious, and they could draw me into sin or away from the faith. So the world is a very unsafe, scary place. It's way out of proportion. The sense of threat is way exaggerated, and this anxiety benefits the religious system. But it's very, very painful to live in that. And with this sense of yourself as bad, you can't trust your heart. You have to rely on the system with this paranoia. There are all kinds of mental health systems that really mimic mental illness. Because in a way, this system is creating dysfunctional psychological patterns in people. And that's what mental illness is. Mental illness can be understood, non-biological mental illness, as a dysfunctional way to produce a certain result, as a survival adaptation that's an overreaction that kind of works, but it really ends up creating pain too. And I see a lot of that in religion.
There's an awful lot of examples, I think, of that. We know, like I said, this week we've had two people on here, I think, that could qualify for they are so entrenched in their beliefs and take it to the extreme that almost you lose sight of just decency as a human being. Like we've had a gentleman on here. I won't mention his name because I don't want to give him any more attention, but he literally sat across from us just like you're doing right now and said that gays and unruly children, in his opinion, should still be executed and carried out by the state. That was motivated by his religion. I mean, that affects you in a way, I think, that is a mental illness. When you think that way, there's nothing you can call it other than that's mentally ill to think that way. What are some of the things that you see when talking with people who are coming out of religion or dealing with them that affects them the most? Like, what has been the thing that has kind of altered maybe who they were really and made them act in a way that they normally wouldn't have?
Yeah, and I do coaching with clients who are recovering from religious trauma and who are going through these transitions. And it's so brutal because every Christian is terrified and is living in fear whether they realize it or not. And it might be at a deep unconscious, subconscious level. Because if you believe in a doctrine like hell, that you could be burned with fire forever for not obeying, there's no possible way that doesn't affect you deeply. You are afraid. You might not be aware of it, but you are afraid. So, and I see this all the time when people leave Christianity, because while this religion can create depression, low self-esteem, you're bad, you're evil, you're wicked, your best isn't good enough, you're not perfect, you're a wretch, it creates sexual dysfunction. I mean, yeah, you hate your sexuality, all kinds of things, right? But it has mechanisms, psychological mechanisms in place to kind of keep those at bay. So it also, while it creates fear, it also has a notion of security that you're saved by the grace of God. So there's kind of a dynamic tension that's happening there. And when people leave religion, the lid is taken off. Those protective doctrines also go away. So they're left with the fear of hell. And there's no assurance to keep that at bay. But it was already all there. You know, it was already all there. Mm-hmm. But so this always happens, is that people are struggling with, I mean, often flashbacks and nightmares of hell. I mean, they've been indoctrinated with violent images of hell and divine wrath. Isolation is really one of the biggest issues. Feeling all alone in the world, because it's scary to know that you can't relate to your family or your church community anymore. Everyone you know might try to reconvert you if you go to them for help. But who else do you go to? You know, or if I'm questioning my religion, I might not be ready to become an atheist, because that might mean I'm going to go to hell. You know, so I might be scared to seek support from atheists too. I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. If I go to the Christians for help, they're going to convert me. If I go to the atheists, they're going to make me lose my faith. So it's a very isolating experience, that questioning period. And when people come out, they often do lose their families and their communities. They often are shunned. So that isolation is really huge. And I mean, I think repairing the self relationship is the biggest thing, is for people a sense of powerlessness. Because we're taught to surrender our personal power, our intuition, and our critical thinking, and there's a feeling like of just the smallness and the patheticness. And it usually takes people a while to learn to trust their hearts, to learn that they can make it in the world, and that society isn't this horrible place, that people are basically good and loving when they have their needs met.
Do you think that most people are religious out of a love for God or a fear of hell? Like, which, in when those two things are weighed out, which one do you think people kind of fear the most? Do they truly love God that much, or are they really that scared of being burned alive for eternity?
I think that the fear of hell is a more powerful motivation than love or heaven. I think that that's just a more basic thing, and I think that bears that is borne out in history. But
this is the
hook and the trap of indoctrination, that there's a mixture of both, and that's why it takes hold, and that's why people stay in it, because religion is not all bad, and I'm not saying that, and people hear me as saying that a lot. I mean, religious people have done some incredible things, and they're often great people, and you know, it does cultivate some great qualities in people. I acknowledge that. But there's a mixture of love and fear, and that's the problem. And a relationship with God looks just like an abusive relationship. And people stay in abusive relationships because there's a mixture of good and bad. When someone has an abusive spouse or partner, the reason that she wants to stay with him is because, you know, maybe he's a really good guy. He could be funny. He could provide you with love and support. And it's hard to leave that. And most of what he does is good. But every so often he says, I'm going to kill you if you leave me. I'm going to kill you if you think about other gods or other lovers or start flirting with secular society or having sex. And that's where the abuse is. It's the mixture. The mixture is confusing. If it was all bad, it would be obvious and everyone would leave. So that's really the problem there.
What about how does the psychedelics, how do they play into this journey? Because Steve and I were talking about doing actually an episode on this because I think it's fascinating. Just the whole theory and things that are associated with that. By the way, just as an aside, are you familiar with the stoned ape theory?
Not by name.
The theory that before we became the final form that we are now, our ancestors, in the transition phase, found a mushroom and ate the mushroom, and that's what kind of brought on consciousness, that unlocked certain areas in the brain, and that became sort of what ultimately led to our consciousness and being aware.
I've heard that before. I think it's a fascinating theory. I don't know that we can really get any kind of proof for that, but
yeah,
I mean, there are definitely psychedelic plants and fungi and animals. These compounds have been with humanity for millions and millions of years, far longer than religion, and they've been used for spiritual practice and psychological and physical healing far longer than religion, and they're still being used that way today. But for me, psychedelics were one of the most integral parts of my healing journey. When I had left religion, I was crushed. I lost my identity, my community, my career, everything. And it was just so traumatizing, such a traumatic experience. And so I was introduced to psychedelics, to mushrooms. And I was amazed. My mind was blown open at just how much healing I derive from these. And I mean, there's so much scientific study being done right now on how these medicines are effective in treating depression and PTSD, all kinds of conditions. But more than that, they helped me reconnect with myself, with my sense of purpose and what I call spirituality. I don't necessarily mean in a theistic sense, supernatural sense, but they really blew my worldview open, these medicines. And I think they have that potential to help people leaving religion. Because I think part of the reason that people stay in religion is because they don't know that there's anything better. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of, they just don't. And they say, too, well, what else is there? What kind of community can I have when I get out? Or how do I get the sense of meaning and purpose that I found in religion? And I think there are so many things that are so much better. I mean, the experiences that I have now are more mind-blowingly fantastic and magical than anything I've read in the Bible or heard about in religion, because reality is so much more expansive than this ancient textbook of ideas that human imagination created. This is reality we're talking about.
Take us through one of your trips, I guess. What's that experience like? Like, what do you see? What do you feel? What, you know? Take us through one, if you don't mind. I mean, if you do, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but I completely understand. But it'd be cool to kind of get the feeling of what you're experiencing when you're taking those.
Sure. I think that one of the greatest powers of psychedelics is, well, it is experiential. And this is kind of the opposite of dogma. Is dogma is about an idea and a teaching. And this is about actually experiencing something first and then forming your ideas after that. So you hear something like love your neighbor as yourself, said by Jesus. And that's a great idea. Yeah, I love that idea. But imagine experiencing yourself as love and the whole universe as love and being engulfed in that love. And that's so much more powerful. So I've experienced a feeling state of being one with the whole universe. And this is a very common experience that people have. And just feeling my connection to everything. And like I was hugged by all of reality. And I've often experienced my consciousness expanding outside of my body, or at least that's my perception, right? And entering the bodies of plants and animals and even other people. And just really through that realization, understanding the connectedness and aliveness of all things and how I'm a part of nature, not separate from it. So in the supernaturalist worldview, there's a spiritual order and a natural order, and the spiritual superior to nature. And we're fighting against nature for survival, and we die in the end, and it's a losing battle. Well, we're not separate from nature. We're not above it. We're a part of it, and we're connected to everything. And so one experience that I had, pretty wild experience, I experienced myself as a woman having sex with a man. And like I felt the sexual organs of a woman in this experience, in this body, and all the feelings of pleasure that she felt. And then after that, I experienced myself being pregnant and having a baby and then giving birth and being connected to this infant with an umbilical cord. Then my consciousness expanded. I experienced myself as birds having sex. Then I expanded again, and I experienced myself as planets and stars having sex and reproducing, which they do, by the way. Sexuality is something that's integral to the whole universe. I mean, like the Big Bang was like a giant orgasm, an explosion of life. Galaxies collide with each other, and the Milky Way is on a collision course with the Andromeda Galaxy, and when they collide in, I think it's 5.1 billion years, they're going to enter a starburst period and give birth to millions of stars. So from that experience, I understood that my sexuality connects me to the rest of nature, that I'm a part of nature, and that I'm not alone in a fundamental sense when I understand that I'm nature and that this whole thing is really connected and it's beautiful and it's sacred. And for me to harm another person is really to harm myself, because there is a sense in which everything is really connected and which all of nature is connected. So I don't see many people running around hitting their foot with a hammer, right? So when you have this understanding and this felt experience that we're all connected, it's harder to destroy nature. It's harder to harm other people when we have these experiences of expanded consciousness, because they tend to lead people to feel these states of oneness and love and unity and connection. So that's just one example. And those have real consequences, because then in that case, for me to love my neighbor as myself, when I experience my neighbor as a part of myself and myself as a part of my neighbor, it just doesn't make sense to do anything else but love them.
Hmm. You know, I have to ask about the birds having sex thing. What was that like? I can't leave that one. I have to know. I wasn't expecting that. To tell you that. What do you, in terms of psychedelics, what were some of the types that you were using? Because I know that there's several different varieties that you use. What are the, in your experience, the best ones to produce certain effects?
Well, that's really an ongoing debate. I really love psilocybin or magic mushrooms. I think they're relatively easy to get a hold of. They're relatively inexpensive. They're easy on the body. I mean, but LSD and ayahuasca, DMT, they're great. I mean, there's so many different. Ibogaine or iboga is a plant that comes out of West Africa, I believe. It blocks the symptoms of opiate withdrawal entirely. This is a medical fact. And it has about, some of my friends who are working with this medicine say they see about 70 to 80% sobriety of hardcore heroin and opiate addictions when they participate in long-term therapy with it, because people have visions and experiences. Often a common experience in this is seeing a slideshow of your life and seeing the decisions that led to the addiction. So these are amazing and powerful tools. And actually, there's a word for them. It's called entheogens. And it means, the translation of that is experiencing the God within. So it's experiencing your own divinity or your own power. And I think mm-hmm. that's part of the solution to the trauma of religion. And what people are looking for in religion is power and freedom from suffering, enlightenment, a sense of meaning and purpose. And that's to be found most powerfully within yourself, not outside of yourself, and within the rest of humanity and within the rest of nature. And so I wish that all this energy, all this human capital that's being poured into these religious institutions, what if we all took psychedelics or not just that, you know, cultivated greater awareness and consciousness and invested all that energy into climate change or saving the planet? What could happen?
I think that I believe it was ayahuasca. I used to be kind of a fan of Graham Hancock and his theories about the Sphinx. And I was watching an episode with him on Joe Rogan one time. They were talking about ayahuasca and how you had to take it under the supervision of a shaman, I believe. He was saying, and that that's how
guide.
He
a guide.
Well, he said shaman. No, that yes, was a term
that
he.
Any type of guide, ayahuasca, because yeah. It's a DMT. It's going to be a DMT trip, so you had to be guided through it.
It was like a root that you boil, and he was saying that he drank that, and he said that it unlocked. It was like going through doors. He would go through a door, and there would be this part of his life that he would almost revisit, and it kind of brought some healing to him in a way for past situations that maybe he either did wrong in or left unfinished. He was able to kind of go back in his mind and finish those off to feel better about them. So it's definitely, Steve, I know you wanted to, you've got some things about DMT that you want to talk about or ask.
Well, I'm more fascinated about the ontology of the shared experiences. But by the way, I to go back just a few, just because I want to touch on something that we had talked upon. You know, you had asked about heaven and hell, which one is actually more influential. And I do think, obviously, that the fear of hell it supersedes the love of God. And the reason I say that, and I want to get this on this particular video, is that I see a lot of theists that don't have a love for God. What I see is a love of the concept of a God. They have an idyllic notion of what Jesus is, this personification of good. An anti-theist would be somebody who isn't against God, but against the concept of God. And I see that a lot with theism. I see a lot of religious people that for some reason, the idea of God is what I think they're in love with, right? But it's not God itself, because there's no object there that I can see for them to have this kind of a love feeling for. But I wanted to say that. But so when it comes to this ontology of like DMT, a lot of people have these shared experiences, like the mechanical elves and the jesters and things of that nature. Now, there's different ways you can look at these types of similarities. You can look at it from a constructionist approach, which would be something along the lines of we all have the same biological hardwiring, right? Or you can take a more literalist approach that they are actual entities and there's actually a couple things in between. What do you think is the reason why people have a lot of the shared experiences when they take DMT or any kind of psychedelic? I mean, do you think that these are just kind of contextual things that people share because we have been exposed to these types of things? And by the way, I have never tried psychedelics. However, I've had lucid dreams galore. It's not quite exactly the same thing, but when you have a hypnagogic hallucination or an auditory hallucination, it's legit. It is very vivid, very real. You are outside your body, or you feel like you're outside your body. I don't believe there's an externalist component to this. But what he's saying as far as these experiences, these are experiences that people do have. They are very real to the individual, whether they're externalized or internalized is up for discussion. But what do you think of the ontology of these shared experiences?
See, this is fascinating because it gets into the topic of spirituality too. And I guess I want to address atheists here too. And I think maybe I fall into that camp, but probably a lot of atheists would disown me because of my views. But regardless, I really encourage a posture of openness here, because there's just so much here that we don't understand. And sometimes people can be really close-minded because a lot of these experiences don't easily fit within a narrow empiricist worldview. And then there's this a priori dismissal that I see people saying, oh, it's all in the brain. There's nothing else going on. And I'm saying, well, you don't know, maybe, but like, let's continue to inquire. And if you're going to talk about these things, like, do so out of actual experience, because this, you really need to experience this stuff to have an opinion about it. Like, take 20 high dose sessions and then come back to me and see if your worldview is not completely different, which is usually the case for people. But that being said, I think that there's a real interaction that's going on with nature and the outside world that's not just in the brain. So there's like this mixture of the two in my experience, or where it is in the brain, and your environment really influences your experience. But I think the kind of experiences that people are having point to some kind of ability of the brain to be like a receiver or a consciousness to interact with other consciousnesses, or there's some realities here that, at least in my stage, I think we're dealing with. I don't think that means that it's not scientific or anything. But so say, here's an example. People commonly, in fact, if they do psychedelics enough, almost always have these experiences. One, dialoguing with entities or aliens, other beings, having conversations, having experiences with these spirit things that they usually, a lot of them, they never saw. It wasn't like they were exposed to these things necessarily before. Past life regressions, or that have implications for, say, reincarnation. This is a real clinical problem for me, or not problem, issue, by the way, because, you know, I talk with people and I'm going to be dealing with patients who have these experiences. So this is actually a practical thing. Like, how do I work with this? And having your like I said, your consciousness expand, experiencing non-duality, not experiencing yourself as an individual or having like experiences of things like death. So there are all kinds of these wild things that I would have dismissed as just New Age bullshit like 2 years ago. But now that I've had enough of these, I just can't fit my mind neatly around them. I'm not saying that it isn't all in the brain, but I'm not saying that it is either. And, you know, if there are other beings, then it's not like they're part of a separate spiritual supernatural realm, because all of reality is a unity. Everything is, you know, there's nothing outside the realm of science. But right now, I feel like consciousness is a different tool of or mode of experiencing reality. And the thing is that these aren't just drug-induced states. People call the psychedelic experience a human experience a lot, because the same mode of experiencing reality can also be triggered through meditation, through deep states of meditation, through yogic practices, or through various means. It seems that diving into these realms or non-ordinary states of consciousness is what they're called, isn't just something unique to psychedelics. It's actually part of the human brain and body. So it's very fascinating.
Absolutely.
And I encourage people to... Go ahead.
No, please finish. We have a little bit of a lag, I apologize.
Okay. I encourage people to actually to check out Eastern philosophies, like Buddhist thought on this topic. I think, and this is also something I see for the future of people who are leaving religion, is exploring consciousness and raising awareness. And I think this is how we can heal as people, raising our consciousness and awareness, kind of stepping outside of ourselves to see how we need to heal, becoming more conscious and mindful of our thoughts and our actions, and then raising that awareness on a societal level too. And I think that there are certain disciplines like psychedelics and meditation that tend to cultivate self-awareness that leads to healing and love and transformation. And Eastern philosophy, like Buddhist psychology, is actually incredibly sophisticated. I was shocked when I started learning about it. It taught me how to relate to my emotions entirely differently, to have this perspective of non-duality. Part of the problem with religion is that it judges everything as good or bad, good and evil, chosen and damned. And really, on an ultimate level, good and evil, there's an element to perspective about it. And when we judge our thoughts and emotions, or when we judge people as bad, that doesn't stop bad behavior. So sin is the problem. Duality is the problem. You know, when people do bad things, we don't fix them by calling them evil. We fix them by saying that, like, there's a reason that you've done these things, and it's not part of your nature. It just is, and we examine that, and we heal through doing that. So anyway, like Buddhism and Eastern philosophy, even Hinduism, there's a lot of profound knowledge that's often very rational in there. And I missed out on a lot of it because I was triggered by it because of my association with religion, and because I was so like, well, I'm an atheist, there can't be anything to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake for atheists to actually relate that to the supernatural. Now, I've had experiences similar to that. I've had conversations with people that were not there, clearly, and when you're in a lucid state. It's very, very strange. And when people are on these trips and they're having these experiences, I think it's inappropriate just to try to by fiat say some kind of theological reductivist approach. Granted, it could be that. It could be because the way we're hardwired, the way the brain is. However, it doesn't explain certain things to me. We have actually had numerous discoveries from people that have discovered shit on these types of psychedelics. Francis Crick discovered the double helix by use of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. The person who discovered PCR, polymerase chain reactions, that was due to psychedelics. There are some things that people have gained knowledge of some kind by taking these things, whether that was given to them by entities. You know, I can't make that kind of leap. Don't get me wrong. I am more of an internalist.
Right.
However, it is such an interesting and fascinating thing to experience. And I will tell people this, if any one of you have never had these experiences and you don't want to try these psychedelics, by the way, I do want to try DMT. I honestly really do. You could do a self-induction yourself. I have done self-induction numerous times. You can induce yourself to an altered state of consciousness. They used to call this transcendental meditation or things similar. And you can actually feel yourself going into this tunnel. You can feel yourself going into this landscape that pops up to you. You can feel yourself walking along the beach. You can feel yourself flying through the air. It is indescribable, but it is a actual sensory experience. You have tactile sensation. You have emotional attachments. These are very real experiences. Now, whether, again, they're dualistic, whether they're ontologically something that exists literally, or even from a kind of a perennial type thing or experiential, I don't know. But these experiences are factual. Scientists have known this for a long time. As a matter of fact, right now, they're doing studies on DMT, and they want people that have shared these experiences to find out why the commonality of these shared experiences happen. So you can actually do these things in self. Have you ever done self-induction as far as like a meditation thing and got into that mental state and have that breakthrough where you're, you know, in a lucid type environment and it's not through by just random thing falling asleep?
Yeah, not quite, but I've had some of these experiences just kind of happen to me too without explanation, which I don't understand. But there's also something called holotropic breathwork. There are workshops put on this guy named Stanislav Grobe, who is a big psychedelic researcher. And he puts on these workshops, and different people put it on, holotropic breathwork, it's called, where you can induce psychedelic states of consciousness or non-ordinary states of consciousness, they're known as, just through breathing, the breathing technique. So similar to what you're saying.
Yep.
I haven't done it yet.
Oh, breathing plays a huge portion. When you're self-inducing into the state, you have to really take large deep breaths. You have to relax yourself. You have to allow yourself to fall into the state. And like I said, I know a lot of atheists are very, very much against these types of things, thinking there's nothing, they never happen. Because some people have never experienced these things. I get that. But
I'm just scared.
Yeah, I think 6 to 9% of people have sleep paralysis, and those people tend to have lucid dreams, so they know what we're talking about. But if you've never experienced this before, I get how people can just by fiat say it's all bullshit and new age woo-woo. It's not. This is actually where it goes into things like psychology and philosophy of the mind. Philosophy of the mind is a huge thing on this, whether these things are actual ontological things or not. But I don't know any serious psychiatrist or philosopher or scientist even that doesn't say these things don't happen. I don't know anyone who would make that kind of argument.
I would be afraid that I would have a horrible trip, though. That would be my thing. I would be one of those people that have just – because there's sometimes that when I'm smoking marijuana that I get
DMT
into
only lasts like 15 minutes, paranoid. Though, so. You're really not going to have a bad trip with DMT, from what I understand.
15 minutes is a long time, though, I'm sure. It doesn't feel like 15 minutes, though, does it?
Well, sure. No. Time, and also, if you take an MAOI inhibitor, it actually increases it much longer to even an hour or longer. So these inhibitors you can take, because what happens, DMT metabolizes very quickly in the body. So you want to take some kind of inhibitor that prevents that metabolization to make the trip longer. And you have to have pretty high doses to get this, what's called that breakthrough. Like I said, I'm not advocating drug use here. I'm just explaining how it is. But the people that have had those experiences, I want to try it. I honestly really, really do. To have that as an educational thing.
Here's what happened on my trip, though. I would be on a shelf in a hardware store as an actual discount. This is an inside story. So you don't know the backstory to this. So it's going to sound really weird to you, Andrew. I'm in a hardware store as a garden gnome, and I'm with the other garden gnomes, but I'm the only one that has a discount sticker on the gnome itself. And so that would be, I would spend 15 minutes on a hardware shelf. I had a viewer call me a discount garden gnome in a comment one time, and it's just stuck with me ever since then. I can't. That's the most hurtful.
That's why you need to have psychedelics to get over it. Actually, he was talking about psychedelics.
Probably do.
And I assume you were talking about microdosing. psychedelics for people to get over anxiety and to have it incorporated in their life for mental disorders, because they are looking at microdosing, very small dosing of LSD, where you don't have a lot of hallucinogenic effects, although it does change your perception of reality somewhat, because any headphones is going nuts. There is always some kind of change in perception. Let me fix this.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. In microdosing, the idea is to take a sub-perceptual dose. So the smallest amount you can basically take, and if you start seeing like snakes and, you know, shapes change, then you've taken too much. Or just any kind of, if you actually start to experience some of these, I hate the word hallucinations, but things like that, perceptual changes, then you've taken too much. And yeah, those are being studied for creativity, inspiration too. Microdosing is a huge thing in Silicon Valley, apparently, and because people realize that all kinds of inventions and art and scientific discoveries have been made through people, like you said, just getting this inspiration or knowledge while they've dived into these kinds of states. So it is fascinating. But as far as the trauma aspect, I think high dose sessions are great for that, as far as, because it's more like doing therapy than taking a drug. The healing power of these things isn't that they're altering your brain chemistry. It's that they're showing you things about yourself. You're doing deep internal work. It's actually really the opposite of what a classical drug is, because instead of just taking a pill that makes something go away, you're doing a deep dive into yourself and learning how to be with yourself and actually process things. So it's really a lot like therapy in that regard.
So what would you recommend to somebody like for myself, that I since I am fascinated by this and I know people are just like, oh, Steve just wants to trip balls. No, I really do want to experience these things for my own edification, because I do like philosophy, and especially when it comes to ontology. What would you recommend? Because I know there's some churches out there that allow for you know, DMT and ayahuasca, but a few other things. But you have to go to a very specific place to go do these things. I live in California. All I can have access to is marijuana. Psilocybin and other things are not legal here. Colorado's looking to legalize it. But unless you're doing a study, how would a person go about doing this properly, safely, and under somebody's guidance, and hopefully legally?
Yeah.
eBay.
Don't do eBay. I don't recommend that. Definitely.
The deep web. Wanna...
yeah, not my recommendation. So the
psychedelic...
the psychedelic movement has existed primarily by the underground. It's been an underground thing because it's illegal, and people tend to kind of frown at that. But really, I think the most accessible way for people is to, there are lots of underground therapists or shamans and people who make their living offering these amazing medicines, and, you know, often risking their welfare because they could get prosecuted. But I think they're doing an amazing service, because most people don't have access to these clinical trials. And, you know, it's time for us to decriminalize nature. These things are a part of nature. And people are looking for healing. People are desperate to get better, and also to harness our creativity and our natural gifts, and to evolve and to raise our awareness. So, I mean, one way I recommend finding out is, a lot of times cities have like psychedelic societies or clubs, or you can find events and lectures being put on. This movement has really caught a lot of steam. Mushrooms and MDMA are in stage 3 clinical trials with the FDA right now, and both of them have breakthrough therapy status. They're being expedited by the FDA for usage in therapy, being overseen by a therapist, because of just how much scientific evidence there is that these things are effective. But until that happens, you know, people have the option, that again I'm not recommending, of using these underground methods, which, again, you go to these events, find people who have these interests, and you're certain to find some access to it with someone who's trustworthy. who has experience administering them, I recommend everyone using a guide, especially starting out, because if you pay attention to your mindset and to the setting and environment that you're in, and you have some counseling about how to deal with these experiences, it makes it very unlikely that you're going to have a bad experience. And if it starts going there, you'll have some tools and help to be able to redirect that. So 90% of bad experiences or difficult experiences happen because of bad environments and people not paying attention to the BRITE protocol. Also, you know, check if there's any contraindications, like do your research. If you're taking, you can't take certain medications with ayahuasca or DMT. And if you have like a schizophrenic history, then that's contraindicated. But by and large, it's very safe and very healthy. I mean, the other thing is that the only other options really are to travel to different countries where they're legal and to take them there. So people are traveling to all kinds of countries, especially taking ayahuasca and these retreats in South America. Or there are also Iboga clinics for drug addiction. So if you have an addiction to heroin or opiates or cigarettes, there's a psilocybin study being done at Johns Hopkins University, I think in Maryland, I'm not entirely sure, but a pilot study on psilocybin for smoking cessation. It was a small study, but they saw after a full year, 80% of the people were still sober from cigarettes. So, but it's amazing.
I'm trying to quit now.
Possible.
Sure. I quit cold turkey. Yeah. It's not easy.
It's proving rough.
It's hard. Right?
As funny as this is going to sound, we are at the hour and a half mark. It seems like it's only been like 45 minutes, but we're at the hour and a half mark. So we're going to kind of wind down so that we can get ready for the next show. Yes, will you please come back? We would love to. I feel like we only got to talk about. Yeah.
Oh, there's so much more. There's so much more. Like we could talk about liberal Christianity too. It's a big
awesome
thing. And there's so much more to talk about. Sex. Yes.
Yeah.
Sexual religious trauma, repression, which is a That's form awesome. Of self-hatred. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to that. I think you everybody's loved it in the I've been watching the live chat. Everybody's absolutely loved it. So this was great. Steve, do you have any I can check that because you're logged in with that.
No, but it was kind of funny because I watch the live chat while we do these things so I can get questions and interact with them and things of that nature. And, you know, everybody was loving you, got into the psychedelic. People weren't quite sure. Then at the end, they're loving you. So you expressed yourself really well and explained it really well. Because, again, people do have this knee-jerk reaction with a lot of this stuff, and I don't understand why. They just, for some reason, think that because they have a particular belief, they have to hold all these other beliefs. And again, there might be some kind of things out there. And I do, and this is my personal belief. I believe there might be some kind of base reality. You know what? I'm going to say there probably is some base reality out there. We have no access to it. We have filters that we have sensory perception filters. We're never going to experience the terrain. We only have the map of the terrain, right? So what I think psychedelics do is this gives you a different perception filter to see what actual reality actually is. Because what the hell is reality? We have no idea. We only perceive it the way we perceive it. And I think that the psychedelics give you a different way to perceive it. But what that base reality is, I don't think anybody has any clue. I don't think we have any real access to it. But it is fascinating the fact that you can perceive reality in different conscious states, and just to poo-poo that away, I think it's wrong because, again, I'm not a woo-woo person at all. But people do just poo-poo it away as woo-woo. But it's not because think what happens
here's
is
the thing.
Because these things are legit,
just
woo-woo
there.
Comes from that, right? What's that? Woo-woo and poo-poo.
Well, you got all these big words before, and then you reduced it to poo-poo and woo-woo.
Here's the thing. Woo-woo is a derogatory term. It really is. And we're doing ourselves a disservice by giving into our knee-jerk reactions. And I think a lot of times people have this reaction because it sounds like religion. And, I mean, that triggered the hell out of me when I left religion. And I moved to the Bay Area of California. And I was like, wait a second. You all are just some weird religious people in a different way, but some of these experiences are just there's a lot more to them. And I encourage openness, because openness is really the opposite of dogmatism. And when we're closed-minded and we're so convinced of our ways without even exploring things, because there's some kind of emotional element there, we run the risk of becoming dogmatic again. And hey, the fun and freedom of not being religious is that we can explore and experiment and learn and be wrong and change our minds and all that stuff. That's the fun.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So we've got just a couple of super chats here that we'll read out. Thank you guys for those.
Can I plug myself too? No.
Oh yeah, we're gonna let you do that right before we close out. They'll be give you the last word, and you can let everybody know where to. There's only four things I need to read, and then it'll be all yours. The Mind of God says, good platform for speaking on important topics. Thank you, Mind of God. We'll see him in a couple minutes, actually. God Servant says, friends, there are people who love God, and there are people who are pretending. It would be very naive to automatically believe what someone says. Hannah Anderson says, thank you for featuring this guest. He's absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much, by the way, for Hannah, for that super chat. And Hannah, from Brian Stevens, smash the downvotes. Get up to 100 upvotes. Let's do it. So thank you guys for those. Now, Andrew, we'll let you have any final thoughts, plug your blog and where people can follow you, and then we look forward to having you back.
All right, everybody. So subscribe to my blog, lifeafterdogma.org. I'm constantly writing. I have hundreds of pages of resources on these topics and issues, and I also offer coaching and support for people who are undergoing transitions, religious transitions, or trying to heal from religious trauma. And I mean, I'm currently going to be working on my thesis for religious trauma and understanding indoctrination and healing it, and also through spirituality or psychedelics, whatever terms you want to use. So you can find me on my blog, on Facebook or Twitter, Andrew Jasko. I'll even give you my email address, AndrewJJasko, JASKO@gmail.com. So give me a shout out. And I love to speak on podcasts, videos, or events. I put on workshops. One of them is called Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion. I have a YouTube video. Go check it out, Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion. And I'm also working on creating a training program for therapy and helping professionals to help people from indoctrination. And I just want to get more exposure. I want to get this idea out. My goal is to promote human flourishing. And I think that no human being can fully shine in a religious system. Most religions tend to oppress and stifle people's spirituality and health and welfare. And there's a better way to go about taking all the best things that religion does. There's a better solution out there. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think that was very well said. Amen to everything that you just said there. It's funny how we find some of the guests that we have on here. I just happened to look at through our Twitter. You know, it'll notify you from time to time, like when somebody follows you. And I was going through the Twitter and I saw that you had followed us, and so I went to your Twitter profile and then saw the Life After Dogma and just started looking around and was like, oh, this guy would be amazing to have on. And we were just going to talk about the religious thing for tonight, and then right before the show he was telling us about the psychedelics and everything else that he did. And so now we've got another time that we'll bring him on, and I think that's amazing. Somebody else that I'm gonna put you in contact with, and I just actually sent her your information now, is Shannon Q. I think you being on her channel and having a conversation with her would be fantastic, because you two would just, you would hit it off so well.
And I want to get this message out there, because there are so many people suffering silently in churches and religious institutions, and a lot of them don't even realize why they're suffering, and a lot of them just don't know what to go do or how to go about it. And
sure,
it just, there's this idea that religion helps people, and there's just so much suffering. So,
you know, I couldn't give you any pushback from anything that you argued. Honestly, you articulated it well. You had good argumentation. I really didn't have anything to call you out on, to be honest with you. I wish next time, or in fact, I think there's going to be more than just a next time. You're going to be back a few times, hopefully. But I would like to get somebody make like maybe like a Christian apologist, maybe like S.J. Thomason or somebody, to kind of give you, you know, their perspective on it, because I think that would only be kind of fair. Because I know Kyle and I really couldn't argue with what you said. I mean,
that'd be interesting. Yeah,
you're right. Yeah. So I mean,
that'd be fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
They probably say stuff like you're making generalizations, or that was just your experience.
Yeah, but we don't agree with them, but I like them. You know, they're friends of the channel. And you know, I'd like to see how they respond to the arguments you were making, because I really do want to see if they have a cogent response for it.
Yeah,
SJ
would be good. SJ would be a good one.
Yeah, SJ would be really good at it. You know,
you know what? They inspire half of my writings too. Just seeing like the bad arguments and following those. It's great.
Really bad apologetics out there. Absolutely bad apologetics.
On Twitter, I'll connect you to SJ, and you can go, because she runs a blog too that's extremely popular. I think she's got like, what, she have 18,000 followers on Twitter now? She's up to, but she writes blogs.
She's got her own Quora questions about her. So yeah, she's pretty popular.
Yeah. So that might be a good, really good conversation to have. But yeah, I look forward to having you you back on, and really thank you for coming on. This was fantastic.
It's been a pleasure.
Sure. And guys, we will close out for here for right now. You can join us back here at 10 o'clock. This is in 20 minutes. And we will have the Mind of God. And I still don't know what that gentleman wants me to refer to him as. So once we get him in and I know what name he wants to be called, I don't want to dox him. But they will be having a debate on biblical prophecy. So that will be live here at 10 o'clock. And we'll see you back here then.
Good night.
Non sequitur. Your facts are uncoordinated.